Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program takes us to Orono and the University of Maine for a talk by Matthew R. Simmons, co-founder of the Ocean Energy Institute in Rockland, author and chairman emeritus of Simmons & Company International, a specialized energy investment banking firm. His talk is entitled, The Dawning of Ocean Energy, Our Last Frontier. If you enjoyed this program and wish to hear it again, or perhaps to share it with a friend, you can do so by visiting our website, mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is Habib Dagher, Director of the Advanced Structures and Composites Center at UMaine.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time to come here, and we have a very exciting event. We have Matt Simmons with us today. Matt founded Simmons & Company. Simmons & Company is the only independent investment bank specializing in the entire spectrum of the energy industry. To give you a sense of how the kind of impact that Matt and his company has done, Simmons & Company acted as a financial advisor to over $143 billion of transactions. Now, that's a lot of billions here, so we're really appreciative for you to be able to come and see us here, Matt, today. I've known Matt for over 2 years now, and it became clear to me not only how successful he is in business, but how successful he is with personal relationships, and he picks the right thing to do. Matt's doing what he does because it's the right thing to do, and that becomes very clear when you work with Matt, and that's why he's so successful at what he does. Matt is a truly has written a book, a groundbreaking book it's called Twilight in the Desert, the coming Saudi oil shock and the world economy. I'd love if you go and read that book. It's just a tremendous book. It's been listed on the Wall Street Journal bestsellers list. If you talk to governments around the country and the world, they all look for Matt for input on energy-related issues. It was really amazing. I tell him, Matt, I'm going to go to Sweden. And he says, Sweden? Here, let me give you a couple of phone numbers to go to. And then why don't you go have lunch with our ambassador in Sweden? And why don't you go have... And then I said, we're going to Norway. He says, no, not a problem. We'll set up a nice big dinner for you in Norway. And then he has the top Norwegian officials here come to meet us. The connections he had globally, the high regard that people around the world give Matt is very well deserved. Matt is truly an ocean of energy, an ocean of thought, and he's going to talk to us today about where ocean energy can take us. Please help me provide a very, very warm welcome to Matt Simmons.
Thank you, Habib, for those kind remarks. I'd come up again tomorrow just to hear that again. I actually spoke yesterday at the University of New England. They have their third annual Business Ethics Lecture Series, and had the opportunity of being introduced by Angus King. And Angus basically started out by asking the audience, he said, anyone here have a home and not have homeowners insurance? He said, let me turn it around. How many of you have homeowners insurance? Yeah, all the hands went up. So that's interesting. How many of you think your house will burn down today? Not a hand went up. He said, how many people think the house will burn down this year? 5 years? 10 years? He said, statistically, the odds of a house burning down is about once every 25 years. And what's interesting is the average homeowner in Maine is paying $500 a year for an event that has a probability of happening one ten thousandth of a percent. He said, how many of you have an insurance policy against energy cost doubling? He said, if energy costs double, it will basically wipe out most of Maine. And he said, what we're now going to talk about is sustainability of energy, and that's how he introduced me. But I'd like to talk about today is how fragile our energy structure is, and raise the question and then answer it. Is it sustainable? And if it's not sustainable, what it means to all of us in the world. It's also interesting, I don't remember very often hearing the word sustainability until 4 or 5 years ago, and it seems now it's hard to pick up a paper without somebody talking about sustainability of this or that or the other. It was sort of interesting to see how many things that sustainability either means or don't, but I highlighted to endure or withstand is probably the most profound aspect of sustainability. Sustainability turns out to be akin to immortality. For societies to survive, they must be sustainable. Non-sustainability is akin to mortality or morbidity. One does not have to be healthy, wealthy, or happy to have a sustainable existence, but some key resources universally underpin society's sustainability. Many examples illustrate how easily sustainable systems can crumble, and we've certainly had a very tragic one recently with Haiti. It's a classic case study of a non-sustainable society long before the earthquakes. But life goes on despite poverty, disease, and plagues, etc., and Haiti will mungle along. I also think just looking back at some of the awful pictures at the end of World War II of Hiroshima, Yokohama, and Dresden, they were all deemed dead zones, but they all three miraculously recovered. So mankind's ability to endure pain and survive has created the world we enjoy today. It's amazing but we just have an inherent endurance to being able to sort of pick ourselves up and get going again. And as a result of all of that, the world today has never been more prosperous in the history of the world. We now have 7 billion people living in a world unimaginably richer than a century ago. While not every country is equally prosperous, the worst parts of China and India are more prosperous than many parts of America were in 1900. In America, 1900 was ravaged by disease, filth, illiteracy, racial hatred. In the 1900, only a tiny fraction of the world was what we deemed to be rich. One of the most interesting articles that I came across about 5 years ago was published in the December issue of 1900 of Ladies' Home Journal. It was basically a two-page article showing what the world may happen in the next 100 years. And it's really interesting. These are sort of hard to read, but the first thing he said is we're going to have trains traveling 150 miles an hour. We're going to be able to get to England in 2 days. We're going to have telephones around the world. Man will be able to see around the world. Photographs will be telegraphed from any distance. The Grand Opera will be telephoned to private homes. Vegetables will be grown by electricity. Few drugs will be swallowed. Coal will be not used for heating or cooking. It turns out in the whole 2 pages, every single paragraph they say actually happened. And the underpinning of every single one of them turned out to be the miracle of modern energy. So if you took away modern energy, not a single one of these dreams would have happened. Creating usable modern energy literally defined the 20th century. This is the great Spindletop well that was drilled in 1901, down about 70 miles east of Houston, Texas. That was the first time that we basically realized that oil wells weren't little tiny wells with waxy oil. Out of that came the first giant oil field we ever found. As 1900 began, we had no electricity, no motor gasoline, no refrigerators, no clean heat. But over the next 5 decades, we created a hydrocarbon society with light, transportation, flying machines, and finally atomic energy. And our health, wealth, and happiness grew exponentially. The energy miracle produced some unforeseen negative events, however. We created war machines that could kill faster than ever imagined. We created a way wider rich-poor gap. We started too many oil wars. We began poisoning our fresh water and air. But we also won World War I and World War II because the West was fueled with abundant energy, and our enemies weren't. I find it interesting, as like many people today, a really historical buff about better understanding World War II, how little we've ever talked about the unique role that energy played in making sure we won World War II and why we had World War II. One of the little-known facts of why Japan bombed Pearl Harbor was that Churchill and Roosevelt were clandestinely secretly meeting up in Halifax. And while Roosevelt was apparently on a fishing trip, the Deputy Secretary of State made the mistake of signing the sanctions against Japan to try to alter their policy in China. And as a result of that, 85% of Japan's oil came from the United States. Within a week, there was a toppling of the Japanese government. And a week later, they began planning the invasion of Sumatra. And they realized they couldn't pull that off without bombing the American fleet in Pearl Harbor. So So had we not sanctioned Japan, whether we would have had a one-front war. Germany invaded Russia when Rommel ran out of gas in North Africa, and they realized they basically couldn't win a war without oil, so they turned to Russia. Had they not turned to Russia, basically, we probably would have been speaking German today. America could never have mobilized the world's mightiest war machine without its abundant energy. And atomic power could not have happened without America's hydroelectric plants. And so oil started the war, and America's vast energy supplies helped win and end the war. In the post-World War II era, the war started down a funny, strange, odd path of a belief that energy will last forever. The giddy news after the war ended accidentally began a 50-year belief in energy abundance. A rapid series of giant Middle East oil field discoveries once the war ended created a belief that the Middle East floated over a giant sea of cheap oil. Most of the world's best natural gas, until very recently, has been flared because it was too expensive to build pipelines to transport it. And atomic energy through the 50s and 60s, before we really had much, was deemed too cheap to even meter. And everyone believed the world would never run out of coal. As a result of that, we started making a series of accidental energy mistakes. In a funny sense, we created the U.S. Interstate Highway System on the basis of which created an insatiable need for gasoline. But it was a dream to be able to drive coast to coast on freeways. We created frequent flyer miles that created money-losing airlines. One of the odd stories that happened to my wife and I about 3 years ago, we were in London in the fall, and our daughter in San Francisco called and said, you know, I might come see you in London this weekend. I said, from San Francisco? Yeah, I found a fare on the internet for $125 round trip. So, well, that's why United is broke. To find a way to use natural gas, we turned nitrogen into nitrogen fertilizer, which created an easy way to feed the world easily, but it also stripped the nutrient-rich soil dry. So it turned out to be a negative consequences again. And cheap oil became cheap gasoline, which led to the U.S. gas wars. Some of you are probably too young to remember when we had gas wars. These were basically gas prices at the service station. I was just about to start college when I, at the end of the summer, drove with a couple of fraternity brothers from Salt Lake City up to Jackson Hole. And I remember when you got to Idaho, we could buy motor gasoline for 11 cents a gallon because of the gas wars. And the lack of any solid data supported this energy cornucopia belief that we all became believers in. I had the interesting opportunity back in the summer of 2006 to co-author an interesting ed-op piece with Stuart Udall, who passed away last month. Stuart Udall was the last living member of the Kennedy-Johnson cabinet. He was the last great believer that conservation and affordable modern energy are each other's best friends. And he was a great American patriot and ever since. It was also interesting. I'd only met Stuart by telephone by that time, even though subsequent to that we became very close friends. And he suggested to his nephew, who's the older brother of the senator from Colorado, he said, you know, call Matt and see if he would be interested in co-authoring an audit piece about all the energy mistakes we've made, because I'm looking back on the 50 years that since I started in Congress, and I think we sort of see eye to eye on things. So what we wrote this article about was 50 years of energy mistakes. And it documented every energy mistake that were made by 10 presidents and 25 different Congresses. So no single American is blamed for our mistakes. So every time someone says, we wouldn't have these problems if it weren't for the Clinton administration, I said, no, or the Bush administration, said, no, it's Eisenhower, it's Kennedy, it's Johnson, it's Nixon, it's Ford, it's Carter, it's Reagan, it's Bush 1, it's Clinton, it's Bush 2, and now Obama. And guess what? That means it's not any of their faults. It was all of our faults. Is that we basically, as a society, just didn't like to think about energy. And the world, therefore, got fat, dumb, and happy about energy. Other than occasional geopolitical jitters, most of the world leaders began assuming we would always have abundant, affordable electricity, natural gas, and more importantly, oil. The only thing we worried about is we had too much coal. And a handful of naysayers began warning that things aren't quite as good as we thought. It got easily dismissed as ill-informed, not grasping the power of technology, Cassandras, kooks, or all three. And since I've been called all three by the same person, boy, I can attest to that. It turned out the energy optimists basically inherited the global bully bit. We had a program about a month ago in Houston called CERAWeek, and the Cambridge Energy Research Associates, and they had 2,500 delegates. And all week, their message was soothing and comforting. You could see it in the Houston paper and the Wall Street Journal summaries every day. We're approaching peak demand for oil was one of their themes. It's sort of a dig at peak oil people. Is it where demand's going to peak? The only supply risks we have are all above ground. Technology once more fooled all the naysayers. And shale gas is a new bridge of energy supply for the next 100 to 200 years. Now, when I'd been traveling that week, and I got back on a Thursday night, and I saw in the paper Friday morning that Nobu Tanaka, who's the head of the International Energy Agency, was speaking that morning at CERAWeek. So I emailed Nobu and said, if you have a chance, let's at least talk by telephone. So about noon, the phone rang, and it was Nobu Tanaka at the airport. And he said, God, I thought you were out of town, or I would have gotten in touch with you. He said, Matt, I got to tell you, I sat there for 2.5 days as one of the 2,500 delegates at CERAWeek. I've never been around a more optimistic group of fools in my life. He said, I am so glad that you came into the IEA's headquarters 2.5 weeks ago and educated all three of us on how illusory shale gas was, or I would have basically witlessly flown across the Atlantic saying, at least we've solved our energy problems. It sort of gives you a notion of sort of what the majority thinking of people that are in the energy business still are today. The energy optimists have some very strong beliefs, but unfortunately, they're all faith-based. None of the powerful energy optimists have any hard data to support their beliefs. I've heard all of them speak enough that I think I know what I'm talking about. Because their message is so pleasant, though, few tend to challenge the lack of data. The data is available, but it's not found in any single easy-to-read source, and it takes work to be a serious energy student. Digging in the data, though, is always a good exercise to do, and it doesn't take real long to find the data that today proves beyond any doubt in my mind that peak oil actually happened 5 years ago. While a lot of the data is still fuzzy, and most is estimated, if you take things just like the collapse of the oil in Mexico or the collapse of the North Sea, there are too many collapses that we just don't have any way to overcome. And so basically, I think we need to get used to the concept that peak oil is not a concept or something that's going to approach it that happened now 5 years ago. The biggest stumbling blocks in this whole thing is getting good energy data. It turns out we have very poor energy data. The EIA, which is the Energy Information Administration, Washington, D.C., provides the highest quality data in the United States for things like what our oil and gas demand is, what our reserves are, and so forth. All the demand estimates are basically just observing changes in inventory, because we really don't have any way to know accurately what demand is. It takes about almost 2 years later for motor gasoline demand, and we finally get the state taxes to see what real demand was, and oftentimes it's off by maybe 20%. We lack any solid data on existing oil supply declines. Nationally, the EIA oil inventories are based on sampling of some key holders on a voluntary basis. And then the samples are all emailed in by Monday morning. Theoretically, they're all supposed to be sampling this morning at 7 a.m. The data gets emailed into the EIA's Washington headquarters, and then they basically put them in their computer and press a button, and they gross them up to every PAD district of the United States down to decimal point accuracy. Stupid. Globally, the International Energy Agency has to rely on what key oil producers tell them. Now, I know for a fact that there's a high degree of skepticism within the leadership of the IEA that Saudi Arabia, for instance, does not have any spare capacity. But because Saudi Arabia says we have 4 to 5 million barrels a day spare capacity, it's not their role to challenge them. So again, we sort of just waltz along. Natural gas data is far fuzzier because vapor is hard to measure than liquids, so we really don't have any good data on natural gas. But that does turn out that there are some things that you can observe with the benefit of hindsight. Onshore oil globally peaked in the early 80s. Abundant oil still continues to flow from 35 to 40 supergiant onshore oil fields, but every one of them are old, and most have passed their peak flow, and the ones that haven't, we don't have any data on, so they probably also have. It was the steady growth in offshore oil that was mainly responsible for the past three decades' growth in oil use. But these fields, too, began peaking, are now mostly depleted. So the industry by the late 90s started pinning incredibly high hopes on deepwater oil for all its supply growth. In retrospect, few of the deepwater projects came close to reaching the targeted production. In fact, of the 100 largest deep water projects done over the last 10 years, only three hit what they were built for. And on average, they came in at about 54% of what they were designed for. So they were poorly designed fields, too little data. And the decline profiles of all these fields turned out to be almost vertical. So it turns out ignorance is bliss. The flow rates of 90% of the world's largest oil and gas fields have never been subjected to an independent audit. Now, would it make you a little bit uncomfortable if all of a sudden the SEC announced that the Fortune 100 had never had an audit? We're just relying on what their internal accountants say they're earning? I think it would terrify people. The analysis of the world's remaining proven reserves has not been audited for decades. We just take people's word. The process of reserve booking still makes Enron's market accounting look solid. There is no data on the quality differentials between our global crude grades. This is an unbelievably important issue because it turns out that the difference between light sweet crude and heavy sour crude is the difference between a jalopy and a Mercedes-Benz. But we don't have any data on that. You just have to anecdotally pick it apart. Capturing decline rates from existing fields is still an art form. It's something the oil companies don't like to tell our analysts. And so most of them basically, they'll tell you what the initial production rate is, and they go radio silent thereafter. So why are so many people so happy? Well, I think human nature thrives on good news and tends to ignore unpleasant news. I think that the deep-seated beliefs are also hard to dispel, particularly when the data is imperfect. There's also the too-big-to-fail syndrome comes into play. I hear this so often, but you can't be right, because if you're right, Exxon's wrong, and look how big Exxon is, or Saudi Arabia. But I think history has proven that we often whistle past the cemetery. Go back to August 1914. Go back to August 1939. Go back to December 6, 1941. And an interesting experience, right after Twilight in the Desert came out, I gave my first big book talk at the National Press Club, and that afternoon I went over to the Wall Street Journal's headquarters in Washington for an editorial interview. While I was waiting, I noticed they had three or four headlines, famous headlines of the journal framed in their lobby. So I went over, and the first one I saw was the Wall Street Journal on the Monday after JFK was assassinated. It was interesting to see how profound they were and how right they were about how big a change this was going to issue. The next one was far more interesting. It was the front page of the Wall Street Journal, published on Monday, December 8th, 1941. And they had a little black block saying we'd already gone to print when we got the news that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. And interesting note, we thought there was nothing important that would go on today. So I read through this entire front page, and you wouldn't have a clue that within the last 24 hours, America had finally entered the war. You go back to the newspapers the week before 9/11, and we didn't have a clue. And so history has shown that we can be happy as can be, and it doesn't actually mean we need to be happy or should. And my friends, I'm afraid we're headed towards what I would call an energy Pearl Harbor. The globe is nearing the tipping point when we will awake, everyone, to the deep energy hole we're in. One of my favorite phrases I heard from an economist in Scotland about 10 years ago, if you ever wake up and find yourself in a deep hole, rule number one is stop digging. Well, I think right now we're actually throwing more shovels into the hole, digging deeper and deeper. So what could trigger this energy Pearl Harbor? Well, a whole series of things could trigger it. Because this is the first time in my livelihood that we've never had any spare capacity at all. And so one thing that could trigger it this year is demand surging ahead of supply, or stable or declining supplies. And all I have to look at is the week monthly data on the double digit growth of oil demand in China and India and the Middle East. Say, I don't think it'll be easy to make it through the year without demand finally starting to seriously outstrip supply. We also have a whole series of geopolitical things that could happen, as in terrorists. What's going on in Iran right now is extremely important, but we hear about it because they really shut down the news. There was a very unnerving news report that came out about 3 weeks ago today that warned any tankers going through the Straits of Malacca, which is very narrow, about 80-mile long line, if they're approached by a boat, blow them out of water, because there's a terrorist warning that they're trying to sink a tanker in the Straits of Malacca. Now, would that be important? one tanker sinking in the Straits of Malaysia would shut down the flow line of oil to the tune of 12 to 13 million barrels a day from the Middle East to Asia. Nigeria is on the verge of a civil war. Venezuela. Saudi Arabia announced 2 weeks ago last Monday that they had arrested 113 terrorists that were all suicide bombers that were trying to bomb Abqaiq, the world's largest oil processing facility. That would shut down 6 to 7 million barrels a day for a long period of time. Almost any accident that blocks any of our straits. We have a very delicate area in where the Gulf of Mexico finally becomes Galveston Bay, and that becomes the Houston Ship Channel. And the Straits of Bolivar, between Galveston Island and Bolivar Island, are about a half mile. Just a tanker sinking there would be a terrible event today. Any key refining explosion would be a terrible event today. So we just don't have any cushion left to sort of tolerate any unpleasant event. So when the world awakes, the energy Pearl Harbor will remind everyone of how we slept through the end of energy prosperity. Turns out Twilight in the Desert was, I think, an important book because it's the first time anyone had taken the time to go through and dig through technical reports and see the real reality of the Middle East, that there was never a giant pool of oil. It was 35 supergiant oil fields, six of which were in Saudi Arabia that were too old. $147 oil was a flashing yellow light that our oil system had reached supply tipping point. The blackouts that we've had were flashing lights that our kilowatt grids were too old in that capacity, but few people wanted to connect any of these dots, and they were also looked at as either a joke or an aberration. Energy scarcity will lead to hoarding. When we wake up to energy scarcity, we will begin to hoard. Hoarding turns out to be one of the most predictable of human events, and we see this all the time in Houston when there's a hurricane warning. If it gets at all serious coming towards the Texas coast, within a wide radius of greater Houston, within about 3 hours, all the water supply is gone, all the toilet paper is gone, all the batteries are gone. Even though in the last 20 years we've only had two hurricanes strike, so we do have a tendency to hoard when we get scared. Motorists will top up their gas tanks. We had a very interesting experience that America didn't pay attention to after Hurricane Ike shut down Houston for 12 days. On September 15th last year, 2008. For the next 3 weeks, we had service station outages that were more widespread than 1979, sweeping everything east of Houston through Memphis, Little Rock, Knoxville, Nashville, down to Central Florida, and all the way up to Maryland. That never got reported, other than CNN, which would occasionally show a Shell tank truck coming to a service station with a line of 50 cars behind it. The reason America didn't hear about this is that our airwaves were totally consumed with AIG, Lehman Brothers, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, et cetera, et cetera. Now, had we not had that been going on, I'm positive that the evening news would have started out every day with the service station outages, and I'm almost positive that with a short period of time, America would top up their tanks. And in about 30 more hours, we would actually drain the gasoline supplies from our system. And then we'd be out of gas. And about 5 days later, we'd be out of food. So that shows you how sort of hand-to-mouth we're actually living today. Homeowners would fill up their heating oil tanks. Within days, America's gasoline supply could run dry, and then hoarding will spread globally, and chaos would soon ensue. In Houston, we have two other problems. Now, I advisedly use that title because there's a fabulous new film just had its grand preview on the East Coast at the Yale University Environmental Film Festival. It's going on through Sunday. And Tuesday night, they had the grand premiere of Houston, We Have a Problem. And I was asked to come because I'm one of the people in the movie. And afterwards, they had the head of the Environmental Energy Group at Yale Law School conduct an interview between the film producer and me. And it was Houston, We Have a Problem. I highly encourage all of you to see this. That came from the Apollo 12 flight. But Houston, we have two other problems here. If the aforementioned problems were not enough, there are two other issues that question further energy sustainability model. The first is what I simplistically call rust. About at least 80% of our global infrastructure to pull hydrocarbons out of the ground, put them in through pipelines and the tank farms and gathering systems and refineries and the whole complicated fuel distribution all the way to our tanks at our service stations are far beyond the original design life, and they need to be rebuilt. We don't have the manpower or equipment to do that. My guess is, on a global basis, if we tried to rebuild, say, 60% of just our oil infrastructure alone, it would cost close to $100 trillion. If we don't do that, then we can almost certainly bank on the fact that we'll face the double indignity of our supply starting to fall and our delivery system collapsing. It's so interesting now that we think more about infrastructure. In fact, as I was driving up today and just coming through Hamden, there's about four tank farms. They're so rusty. And then I went under the railroad bridge, and that was even rustier. Well, the interesting thing is you can see under the railroad bridge. If we could levitate our pipeline system out of the ground, I think we'd pass out by how rusty and leaking it is. But we don't know about it until all of a sudden you have a cave-in. And then we have a related problem. We have an aging workforce. The industry is finally starting to do some serious analysis of the fact that we went for almost 25 years without hiring anybody. So we have a lost generation. And some of the studies that are now being done indicate that over the next 5 to 7 years, about 65 to 70% of the energy workforce will have retired. It takes a long time to train energy workers. We don't have the schools even to do that today. But without energy, the world soon stops. Without ample oil, transportation systems stops, and then food supplies run out, and then farming ends. Without electricity, our water system stops. And this morphs into an energy hydrogen bomb. And I just wondered if Stephen King could even come close to writing a scarier novel. But these are all things that could happen. And it turns out, interesting enough, that an issue I really didn't know much about until about 6 or 8 months ago, water scarcity, and now I think I know a lot about it, unfortunately, poses a far greater risk. As precious as energy is, water is priceless. Without water, society dies. Without water, most modern energy sources stop. It was actually interesting, on March 22nd this year was the 18th annual World Water Day. And I had about four people from Europe send me emails about this. So I looked carefully in scanning all the newspapers I could find. There wasn't a single paragraph about this in any U.S. newspaper, which shows you how little we think about water. Let me show you why fresh water is becoming scarce. Only 2.5% of the Earth's water is fresh. The rest is all salty. It turns out of that 2.5%, 2/3 of that are represented by ice caps and glaciers. All but a few of the remaining drops lie in underground aquifers, which are very hard to measure and very hard to know when they're running dry until the well runs dry. It turns out that rivers and streams hold just 0.06% of the world's total water. 3/4 of our lake waters lie in three lake systems: Siberia's Lake Baikal, which is now very polluted, North America's Great Lakes, and the East African Rift Lakes. Too many of the world's key regions now suffer water shortages. Most megacities in the world, which are cities exceeding 10 million people, have water constraints. Beijing's facing terrible water constraints. Jakarta, Manila, Mexico City, Mumbai, the list goes on and on. Water tables in too many arid regions are now far too low, including Southern California, the southern parts of the Ogallala High Plains Aquifer, including all of Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, Florida. The water crisis is tragic throughout Africa, so this is not a crisis we worry about might happen in 20 or 30 more years. This is a crisis that probably started happening maybe 15, 20 years ago. And not all surface water is easily usable. Easily accessible surface water is only a fraction of the global water supply, and the balance is brackish groundwater and aquifers, or recycled water or gray water. And all groundwater extraction requires energy-intensive pumps. So that's why if you lose your energy, you can't get the groundwater out. This is an interesting graphic that my assistant found for you that really puts this in perspective. It said if all the water on Earth could be placed inside a water cooler, the available fresh water would amount to 1 tablespoon. And interesting. It turns out also that our global water infrastructure is rusty. The USA has one of the finest water and wastewater distribution systems on Earth, but almost all of it was built in response to the Clean Water Act of 1972. And much of this infrastructure is nearing the end of its design life. The cost to keep clean water available throughout the OECD and the BRIC economies, which is Brazil, Russia, India, and China, is estimated to cost between $15 trillion around $15 trillion between 2008 and 2025. So these are big numbers. Water is also an enormous business. The global water industry is the third largest industry on Earth, after oil and gas production number one, electricity generation number two. Steam electricity is the greatest water user, 48%. Irrigation use is second, 34%. The public supply ranks as the third largest user. Drinking water is actually a very relatively small user, and our bathrooms, on average, use more water than what we drink. So you hear people say, well, just don't drink much water. That's actually not the problem. And we could do all the water conservation with our households in the world, but we can't. But it all gets blown away by how much water we use in creating power generation. A lot of industrial users have an intense use of water. I found these numbers quite interesting. The semiconductor industry uses 2,300 gallons of ultra-pure water to manufacture 1 6-inch wafer. Large semiconductor plants use up to 1 billion gallons of water each year. The energy industry consumes enormous volumes of water. This was a really surprising statistic I came across, and I went to three different refinery experts to make sure it was real. A 300,000 barrel a day refinery uses 21 million gallons of water an hour, or 210 billion gallons of water each year. We're obsessed right now with this new phenomenon called shale gas. It's unbelievably water intensive, and then you have to create a slurry that contaminates the water. The Barnett Shale, which is the Fort Worth Basin, in their first 10,000 wellbores, used up 70 billion gallons of water in 3.5 years and contaminated it. And that's going to be a really nasty issue at the EPA this year. Creating usable oil involves copious amounts of water. Many oil fields maintain reservoir pressure through massive water injection, and the processed water cuts then removed and re-injected with even more new water. Heavy oils only come to the surface through massive steam soaks. If you go out to California, out to Kern County, where Bakersfield's to the head of, it's unbelievable to look at the heavy oil huff and puff steam operations. Sort of looks like the moon, this big wide valley of these things pushing steam into the ground. And then you step back and you say the San Joaquin, California now has a very serious water problem. The San Joaquin Valley has a drought. And they have a very scarce natural gas, and yet we're using a prolific amount of water and natural gas to create steam, to actually melt the tar, to create heavy oil that then needs to be processed and processed and processed. And it makes no sense, but without it, California doesn't exist. Creating 1 gallon of gasoline uses between 2 and 3 gallons of water at the refinery. No one's ever really thought about how much water it takes to consume 85 million barrels of oil each day. It's never been calculated. In fact, I was mentioning earlier to Habib that the National Geographic's April edition is entirely devoted to water, and it's probably one of the best collections of a bunch of water facts that I've ever seen. But what I found amazing is that there's not one single paragraph in there that deals with the water used to create energy, something we don't even think about. There's also some interesting contrast between oil and water. First of all, they don't mix, which is why aquifers became the great basement of all giant oil fields. The water's compressed, and the pressure precipitates it out of the ground. Oil is a depletable, non-recyclable resource. Water's replenished, but also a depletable resource. Oil's privately owned. Water generally a public resource and almost free. Oil's an energy resource which luckily has some substitutes. Water has no alternative substitute, so which is the most valuable? It turns out that great rhyme from Coleridge's Rhyme with the Ancient Mariner, written in 1797, water, water everywhere with not a drop to drink, turns out to be very apt today. If our energy supplies are feeble and in decline, if our potable water is shaky too, then how will the world survive through 2025 or 2015? It will be a struggle unless we invent a new energy source that can scale and is technically viable. So can our solutions for replacing energy be from our oceans? Could ocean energy be our only viable solution? Luckily, 71% of our globe is our oceans. Luckily, 60% of the world's population live within 50 miles of our coastlines. There is a low risk we could ever run low on seawater. If rising sea levels result from global warming, there's a real threat. Using seawater to create energy also helps this risk too. Turns out the ocean wind is the United States' greatest energy source. This data comes from, I got this from Habib, but it actually comes from the U.S. Department of Energy's NREL officials. 61% of the United States offshore wind resources occur 10 to 20 miles offshore in water depths exceeding 90 feet. The total capacity of U.S. deep water wind is 1.533 gigawatts, and the total U.S. electricity capacity in total is 1.1 thousand gigawatts. So we actually have more offshore wind than we have electricity use in the United States. And ocean wind is the United States' greatest energy source we've never tapped. Now here you see the incredible Gulf of Maine, but look around the Gulf of Mexico. Look at the west coast of America. So this is something that can work in a lot of places that we don't know about today. So that's why UMaine, the Department of Energy, and the Ocean Energy Institute are launching the Manhattan Project. Midcoast Maine will soon become home to a Department of Energy research laboratory and a lot of its headquarters right here. And three new offshore wind turbine projects will begin the long march towards capturing energy from our oceans. And the first big project is the world's largest offshore deep water wind project, designed not to just create kilowatts, but to turn the kilowatts into liquid ammonia, NH3, from offshore wind. And the byproduct, liquid ammonia, is not carbon. The byproduct is potable desalinated water. With proper combustion, nitrogen burned does not even create nitrogen oxide. So NH3 and desalinated water could literally be the energy's genuine holy grail. And since it scales as oceans are all over the world and winds are prevalent around the oceans. So the oceans do hold the key to the world's sustainability. Offshore wind is real. It can create electricity that combined with water creates hydrogen. Three parts hydrogen and one part nitrogen create NH3, which internal combustion engines can use today. So the next steps will include research into capturing energy from ocean seeps, aquatic plant life, tides, waves, currents, ocean thermal energy conversions, gas hydrates, which the ocean floors are laden with, and other sources. And this is something that we've barely scratched the surface of. So the twilight era of modern energy and water is here. The world's two greatest resources that created our economic disparity are both waning. And we priced modern energy so low, and we gave away water. But now, unless we change our way, the world teeters on darkness. But could darkness soon turn into dawn? And I do believe we are at the dawning of ocean energy. The solution, ironically, was right in front of us. Our oceans contain remarkable energy that was never accessed or tapped. And the Gulf of Maine will soon become a Silicon Valley and be providing ocean energy that can be captured, processed, and turned into a replacement for modern energy and water. Thank you.
Matt, thank you. That was fascinating. Do you have time?
Sure, absolutely.
We can take some questions for Matt here. This is very fascinating.
Can you talk a little more about what your company does to analyze projects or analyze issues like peak oil? Do you have analysts working on these things?
No, that was my hobby. I'm now chairman emeritus of Simmons & Company, but literally as a weekend hobby and something to do on airplanes, I got so annoyed that as we started out concentrating in 1974 on serving the worldwide oil service industry, I didn't know anything about energy, but we did subscribe to all of the leading sort of energy forecasting services. And so we were basically encouraging all of our clients at the end of 1981 that the rig count would probably rise forever. And then come Good Friday, well, I was thinking about this on last Good Friday because I keep reminding my wife it was Good Friday 1982 that my life profoundly changed when the oil service industry collapsed. We went through a 15-year depression. By the end of the depression, 95% of all the oil service companies had either been consolidated or gone out of business. And so to live through that was a very sort of painful system. So in the early 80s, I started wondering, why did everyone get it wrong? So I started digging into energy data, and I soon became an energy data nut. And that really basically is my hobby. I don't play tennis, I don't play golf. I take energy data and study it. And as I started pulling away from day-to-day activities, I had even more time to get into data. And I started becoming a frequent industry speaker. And I would hear all these goofball nameplate energy economists talking about how modern oil field technology had made oil cheaper and cheaper to drill, and we would never drill dry holes. I thought, man, alive, that's the same technology our firm did all the financing for and saved. We don't understand the role of technology. Technology has created decline rates that go like that versus decline rates that go like that, so it's made the matter worse. So I became a more and more frequent speaker, and then I finally decided to dig into the Middle East, and ended up, that's when I really basically dropped the CEO title, so I just couldn't do both. So that's all been done on my own time. Now, I am lucky that we have an enormous amount of, because of all the projects that are going on around the world at each day, I get an enormous amount of real operational data from our guys, but I don't have a staff of analysts.
Because you're helping to fund the people that are producing the oil, you get some of that data that
otherwise... Yeah. I'd also say, though, that it ought to be encouraging for all you students that if I could do this part-time while I was running the company, anybody could become an energy expert. It isn't actually very difficult. It's surprising how few people have actually taken the time to do it. But I would say any one of you could say, yeah, within 5 years, I'd like to be known as the leading authority on almost any matter of energy, and you could do it. Other questions?
I didn't quite catch the link to the nitrogen in the ocean and ammonia.
Yeah, it's. I went over it fast because it's and I'm not a technical person. I wish I had. Laurent Schmidt was at the University of New England yesterday, so I had Laurent stand up and technically go through this. But what you start out with is the fact that offshore wind can easily be turned into electricity. That we know. We also know how to basically take electricity and create desalinated water, because we've been doing this actually in the National Geographic. There's a section on desalinated water. It shows the schematics of the biggest forward step called forward osmosis, which is a totally different way than reverse osmosis. So we have that. And there's some tweaks coming that'll make it even better. So once you have desalinated water, then through electrolysis, and there's some new processes being done that will actually circumvent some of the electrolysis and make it cheaper, you end up with hydrogen. The problem with hydrogen, it's a very unstable energy source. So what you do is you strip out one part nitrogen out of our air and combine it with three parts hydrogen, and in simple terms, it dummies down the hydrogen and allows it to be carried and burned. And what's nice about it is that other than the cost of your composite structures, no one's ever going to charge you for the wind or the ocean water or the air. So you have as close to free energy as we'll ever get the rest of our lives. And you can also alter the mix so that if you're in an area that really doesn't need transportation fuel very much but is in a serious drought, I just make desalinated water. So if we had three or four of these big turbines already in the Gulf of Maine, this winter would have been a natural opportunity for some entrepreneurs to buy some of the old obsolete single-hull tankers that now can't be used in the OECD and clean them up and turn them into water wagons and send the water to Haiti. You get paid by the World Bank. I think within 5 years, we'll actually be paying more for water than we are for gasoline today. So I think creating water is going to be a very valuable product. But creating a carbon-free, non-emission transportation fuel that can work in our current fleet is totally invaluable. So these are two goldmine products. It'll blow away the value of kilowatts.
I noticed you don't really talk too much about nuclear energy. What is, like, in all your research and experience, what's your thought on the new wave of nuclear energy?
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that, because I want to actually mention a few things about coal, too. I didn't really ever understand nuclear power, and for years I was sort of thought nuclear power made it so hard for people to be competitive in natural gas. I didn't like nuclear power, so I was sort of happy when we shut down Three Mile Island. It took me probably 20 years later to start realizing how unbelievably beneficial nuclear power should have been, and how badly the world screwed up by not following the French and really embracing creation. But I think today it's one of those things that basically we sort of ran out the clock. We have an enormous struggle in the United States, for instance. We have got to replace between 30 and 40 of our nuclear power plants sometime in the next 20 or 30 years. In fact, there's a huge controversy that's just risen in the last 10 days about the big nuclear plant up the Hudson River. They're apparently having some really bad operational problems. But if they shut it down, Manhattan would have a blackout. Roscoe Bartlett, who's one of our few scientists in Congress, has the best, and he's been a congressman for 23 years in Frederick, Maryland, has the best staff in D.C. on energy stuff. And this work they've done indicates that you probably, in building a 1,000-megawatt nuclear power plant, you use so much energy in base, because it's reinforced concrete, that it's probably equal to about the same amount of energy a nuclear plant produces in the first 10 to 15 years. So on a net present value basis, you could say it's a net energy loser. Now, the argument is, yeah, but it lasts 45 or 50 years. And it's been a long, long time since we've found any high-quality yellow cake. Now, I was in grade school when Charlie Steen in Moab, Utah, found high-quality yellow cake with a Geiger counter. Today, we're getting out of mine tailings. So you put all those together, and you say it's a shoulda, coulda, woulda. But we shouldn't be basically resting our hopes. And let me turn to coal, too, because that's another area that's far less understood than we should. And I think this terrible accident last weekend in West Virginia highlights the problem we have with coal today. Back in the rich era of black coal, we had mine faces that were basically 400 or 500 feet thick. If you go to the New York Times diagrams in the Massey explosion, they're going in, what, a mile or so on seams that are basically this high, this thick. In the Illinois Basin and Ohio Basin, to mine the coal, they put individuals on Guernseys and send them in. So that's what our remaining coal supplies do. That's why they're basically, knocking off mountaintops, is to get the remaining amount of coal flakes out of them. And then you have things like the Powder River Basin, which is basically dirt with some coal flakes in it. One of the interesting articles that I've ever read about this was John McPhee's book called Common Carrier. And one of the chapters he has in this is a coal train, a unit train, a specific unit train, that basically traces you through the incredible effort to fill it up with 19,000 tons of coal. And then the excruciating effort to make the rail ride from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming all the way down to a power plant 20 miles outside of Macon, Georgia. Gets to the power plant, the 19,000 tons, all the cars are pneumatically flipped upside down, and the stuff's on the ground, and the coal train goes back empty. And then the chapter ends. There's enough coal on the ground for 9.5 hours of running the plant. That's dirt with specks in it. So we really don't have anywhere near the coal resources that we've always believed. Yes?
Ignoring the political issues, what's the potential and the technical issues associated with the new East Coast oil leases that the president announced recently?
First of all, I think that was an amazingly positive event. And in my book, that's going to be looked at as Nixon goes to China. And unfortunately, it's something we should have done 20 years ago. The biggest problem now we have is that we don't have any knowledge about structures. So you don't go out and just start drilling wells. These are very expensive wells. So I think it'll probably take 2 or 3 years of extensive seismic shooting before we'll even know in that small area from Delaware down to Central Florida. We know a lot more in that little sliver in the eastern part of Gulf of Mexico, but even then they wouldn't touch the going close to Mobile Bay, which is where you have supplies because of this issue of tourism on the beaches of Florida. Well, when Florida has a massive blackout for a week or two, they'll change their mind real quickly. But I don't think optimistically that as much as we could ever find, it would replace the depletion we're going to see in the next 3 or 4 years. But doesn't mean we shouldn't have done it. And I think it'll be successful enough that it'll awaken all the other states to say we too would like to have some offshore drilling, because the technical reality is we have not had an offshore exploration production related oil spill for 3 decades. All of our spills come from tankers. The tankers come because we didn't produce oil domestically. It was one of those just terrible mistakes that the United States made. And ironically, it all started after the Santa Barbara oil spill at the end of January 1969. And this was the time that I finally met this commercial diver and raised money for his company, Oceanarium, that led me into being in the investment banking and energy business. But it was so interesting to look back and see that the Santa Barbara oil spill was a very minor event. And had Fred Hartley, who was the chairman of Unocal, who was rushing around like a madman trying to figure out what to do, not had on one of the night news channels some reporter stick a seagull in his face dripping with sweat, and he used the F word, that created Earth Day. And for the next 40 years, the green movement started trying to shut down fossil fuels versus being like Stuart Udall, appreciating that fossil fuels were the best friend the environment ever had. Again, we'll look back and say it was a colossal mistake. Other questions?
I have one here, Matt. You talked about shale gas.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you look at the major corporations, oil corporations today, they're all rushing to buy shale gas.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks that's the future. Natural gas prices are at all-time low today. People say that that's the future. And so, we met last week or a couple of weeks ago with Statoil, and they're out there rushing to invest in natural gas. Can you tell us what your perspective on that? Why are all these guys doing that?
They can book reserves. They can book reserves. It's just I'll tell you an interesting story. Two weeks ago yesterday, I went to Dallas for the day to SMU because it was the second official event of the George W. Bush Institute. It was called Natural Gas Nation. And there were 270 of us there, and we spent all day, there were about 50 panelists talking about various issues related to how do we make sure that this miracle is real and we don't blow it. And it was interesting that at every coffee break, I would have a group of people come up and say, do you believe this? I say, no. You don't? Oh, it's outrageous. It's a hype. But they all do. I say, I know they do. Well, why don't you believe it? I said, several reasons. First of all, the decline rates on the shale gas from all we know today are vertical. And in the Barnett Shale, for instance, the initial production starts out at 100 units, and at the end of the 12th month, you're down to 25 units. At the end of the 24th month, you're down to 5 units. And at the end of, 75, 25, and 5. And then, so at the end of 36 months, you're down to 5%. In the Haynesville, the best well that came on a few months ago started at 30 million cubic feet a day, and 90 days later, it was down to 3. A 90% decline in 90 days. If that was the only issue, then it just means we just need to have a sewing machine and just keep punching more wells. But since to frack these shales, you're talking about an enormous amount of water that has to be mixed into a slurry and then pumped into the ground to bust apart the non-permeable shales. And that's why the average Barnett well takes 7 million gallons of water. And then when it comes back out of the ground, it's contaminated. And it's the contamination issue that's going to be a real nasty issue this year, because the EPA has finally realized they've had enough lawsuits, and the lawsuits aren't coming from Vermont. They're coming from Texas. Municipalities, that something's happened to the water supply. And then, if someone ever did an energy meter, it's like a nuclear plant, we don't have an energy meter, and collected all the energy that's required for these water trucks that are arriving every 3 hours, 24 hours a day, and then all the pumping units for 30 days that are shoving this stuff into the ground, and then all the water truck disposal trucks and the fuels you're using, and then all the crews that come in pickup trucks and do two shifts a day, I'm not sure that the energy expended, it's a different form of energy, might not be equal to or more at least the first 12 months of energy get out from the shales. Other than that, it's a good energy source. But I tell you, it was fascinating to hear how many of these speakers, all they knew was the 200-year supply and how much they could book. And it's amazing how few people in the energy business have done their homework on this. Boyd and Gray, which some of you might know because he spends a lot of time in Maine, was the chief counsel of the White House in the first Bush administration, and he then became ambassador to the OECD. And we got to know, so there are kids being at Groton together. And what Boyden came up after Dan Yergin was the keynote speaker at lunch and said, Matt, I'm really proud of you. You didn't stand up at the end and use some swear word. How did you keep your cool? I said, I just didn't listen to him. Other questions?
Why do you think the peak oil ideas are not getting factored in very heavily to, say, the Energy Information Administration's reference forecast? I just looked at it again before coming over, and there are two interesting things going on that keep prices relatively low, both for natural gas and for oil in the reference forecast. One is there's an assumed one-third decline out to 2030 in energy intensity per dollar of GDP. So that's on the demand side, keeping prices relatively low. On the supply side, I thought what I would see is unconventional fossil sources looming much larger and conventional ones declining but being more than offset by unconventional. It's not true. They have conventional sources of fossil fuels and oil and natural gas also going up.
Yeah.
So what's your explanation or thoughts on why peak oil? Certainly if you look at the peak oil forecast, we're on the downside. So we should see the conventional production decreasing, not increasing.
You know, the EIA is an interesting organization that was slapped together very hastily after the 73 oil crisis. And we created an oil collection system and staffed it with some bureaucrats. And the bureaucrats were replaced by other bureaucrats. And they kept creating a more and more elaborate collection system and computer system. And I was one of the first people about a decade ago that actually got into the details and said, this is all broken. But boy, you go to Washington and tell them that, they cry. And so we had one senior government official after another over the last 20 years. Don Evans, who was Secretary of Commerce for about 6 years, who was a real believer that I knew what I was talking about, after he retired, he said, you know, Matt, what in the world are those stupid EIA people doing? He said, well, I would have to give a talk related to energy. I would make sure that my staff never contacted them because otherwise they'd send me the script. The IA in Paris was actually even worse. And I became their kind of Darth Vader for a while by being throwing so many brickbats on him. And then finally they got a chief economist, Dr. Fadi Birol, and we became soulmates. And then Claude Mandel was retired, thank God, and they replaced him with Mr. Nobu Tanaka. And Nobu Tanaka came in with a fresh look, and Fadi got me together with him, and we really hit it off like a house of fire. And so last year they produced in the first detailed, in their big World Energy Outlook book, the first detailed assessment done on a bottoms-up field-by-field, taking the best data they could get. And it has an interesting graph showing from here to 2030. Of the dark blue is the current base that goes like that, going from sort of 70 to 25 million barrels a day. The next graph is light blue going like this, and it's all the stuff that's yet to be yet to be brought on or found. And then the top thing that goes a little bit, but what they casually state intentionally, because as they said to me, it's a little bit like being in a large auditorium and realizing the auditorium's on fire. You want to gracefully say, just quietly go out. What they basically said is in clear words as can be, to keep supply flat between here and 2030, we only have to add 4 new Saudi Arabias. What's also interesting is that at the end of April, there was a very important study released in the UK. It was co-authored, a big task force, but it was co-authored by the chairman of Scottish Southern Power and Richard Branson. And it's the best clarion call I've ever seen to a government saying, let's wake up to the fact that oil peaked and what are we going to do about it? So finally, we are starting to get some traction in a surprising number of places. The Chinese have been terrified about this for several years and they're acting with their feet. Why the United States government? I don't know. I think in the United States we tend to listen to economists. Economists are optimists. And they just weren't, and I guess because we have, you know, we're the resident experts of all these oil companies, and the oil companies don't have a clue. I had a friend this morning called me from Houston, and he said, you see, you know, I've been, I really want to, he's trying to do a project with Exxon in Madagascar, and he said, I really want to get these Exxon people off this kick, because you're one of our advisors. Every time I meet with them, somehow I all get surrounded. Why are you hanging around that odd guy, Matt Simmons? So he said, I want to sit down one time and get him face to face, because none of these three guys have ever met you. They just hear about you in their headquarters. So it's an odd group. I also find it really odd when I go back to that interesting fact of the world's three largest industries, oil and gas, power generation, and water. We don't know anything about any of them. But we know a lot more about breakfast cereals than we do about the three most important things on Earth.
What sort of storage solutions does the Institute have planned to deal with the intermittency and seasonality inherent to wind power?
Well, first of all, that's a far bigger issue if you were talking about sending it back to the grid. But what we're hoping to do is go far beyond that and not deal with the grid. And then the fact that you have variability doesn't matter because you can store it. So it really just dramatically changes some of the fundamental challenges that wind has. Well, you've been a very patient audience, and I appreciate being here.
You've been listening to Matthew Simmons, co-founder of the Ocean Energy Institute in Rockland, on Speaking in Maine. He spoke recently at the University of Maine in Orono. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, you can do so by visiting our website, mpbn.net. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find a listing of available programs, including this, and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. A service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of the program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.